See Radio 3, it's midday, and now time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Marianne Ohota is an anthropologist and a broadcaster. She's fascinated by what it means to be human and why we behave as we do. Her work has taken her around the world, from the poorest parts of Dhaka and Delhi to the Chernobyl nuclear disaster zone. She's lived with yak herders in the high plains of Tibet and sailed across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Closer to home, she's written two books about British archaeology, full of tips on how to read the landscape from ancient burial mounds to medieval woodlands. As we'll hear, landscapes have inspired a lot of her musical choices, from the Scottish Highlands to Mount Fuji in Japan. But your first piece, Marianne, is linked to one of your earliest memories, listening to classical music.
Yeah, I had these two tapes that were mine, some of my prized possessions. I had a copy of Now 11 with I Should Be So Lucky by Kylie Minogue, and a double tape which had Scheherazade, Rimsky-Korsakov on one side, and the other one was the Moonlight Sonata. And I really remember clearly the cover art for this little cassette, and it was this watercolory painting of a moon, full moon, hovering over a lake with the silvery reflections. And I think the thing that I loved about it was, A, as a child, you know, you don't have control over so many aspects of your life, but this I had. I could choose what music I was going to play. But also the thing that I loved about it was that it transported me. It made me imagine things in my mind, kind of paint those vivid, glorious, rich pictures. And the movements of the Moonlight Sonata are so different that they take you on a journey, an emotional and energetic journey.
Well, I was going to say, I'm rather glad you've not chosen the very familiar romantic opening, but you've chosen the Presto Agitato, which is quite a dynamic, rhythmic piece, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of think of the moon, it's all watery and soft and a bit sleepy, perhaps, nighttimey. But then you've got this third movement that's vivid and jumpy and agitated, and it forces you to be creative about what the music is inspiring in you.
To be excited.
I think so. played this to my four-year-old the other day. And he picked up a scarf, a thin silky scarf, and he started dancing around the room. And I said, oh, what's it making you think? And he said, fairies, full of passion and energy. And I thought, that's brilliant. I mean, there's no wrong answer, is there? If it's fairies, then it's fairies.
Well, I was thinking presto agitato wouldn't necessarily be the best way of getting to sleep when you were listening to that. So that was the third movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, presto agitato, played by Stephen Harf. Marianne Ohotter, you grew up near Chester in the northwest of England.
Yeah, I grew up in a very standard semi-detached house on a suburban street in a kind of little village that's next to the light industrial estate bit, you know, not chocolate box rural countryside. It's kind of the working countryside.
But you did have very interesting cultural influences in the shape of your parents' nationalities.
Yes. So my mother's family are Indian and my father's family are Polish. His parents moved to the UK after the war. And my mum grew up in Mumbai now, and her father was a flight engineer for Air India, so was posted to London for a period of time. So my mum stayed and settled. But for me, that meant that growing up in quite rural, quite white, quite middle-class Cheshire, I think I always had a sense that our family was a little bit different to everybody else. And when we had school holidays, other people would go to, you know, the south coast of Spain or France, and we would try and go and visit family somewhere. So when I was about five, I went to India, and when I was 10, and, you know, you're assaulted by the richness, the senses. It's hot and it's dusty and everything smells different, and the bustle of the mass of humanity and all these different people kind of cheek by jowl. Cows walking up highways, you know, rickshaws and bikes and people selling bananas on sticks. And it was just overwhelming and utterly enthralling. And I actually, India's quite a difficult place to travel. It's not an easy place, I don't find, to be particularly. But it really planted very deeply the idea that what you think is normal in your day-to-day little world isn't for other people. And I think that's certainly what drew me into anthropology. And that's a kind of an underpinning conceit. Challenge your own preconceptions.
And also perhaps the fact that your mum was passionate about the natural world and introduced you to the great outdoors on walking expeditions.
Yes. So my parents divorced when I was quite young. And so my mum was raising me and my brother as a single parent. And money was tight. Time was tight. She was a phenomenal parent. And we joined a local conservation group. And so we'd go out on a Sunday morning, we'd go out and me and my brother would be kind of, you know, given tools and kind of shown how to coppice trees or how to help the grown-ups repair footpaths. And this conservation group decided they were going to go camping for a weekend in Snowdonia National Park, or Eyrie now. And I remember we arrived after dark to this place and you could feel almost the weight of the mountainsides either side of us. And I could hear the trickling, tinkling water of a stream or a river somewhere nearby flowing over these rocks. And I couldn't see where we were, but it smelled different and it felt different. And we put the tent up with, you know, head torches and whatnot. And then I remember waking up and kind of peeping my head out and just going, oh, because there was the valley bottom, there was a lake in front of us and this river along the side. And it was just amazing.
Is one of the reasons that you don't so much listen to music outdoors because, as you've just described, there is a music, a natural music?
Yes, exactly so. I find it really baffling, not to judge other people's choices, but I find it really baffling when I see people hiking or what have you with earbuds in, because they're tuning out the whole reason that I'm there. I want to hear the crunch of the land under my feet. I want to hear the bird song. I want to hear the whistling of the wind. I think those are the things that make me feel alive. But that said, music that captures some spirit of the outdoors that I listen to when I'm at home or in a car or something like that, I mean, that's perfect.
Well, that takes us nicely to your next choice.
Yes. So this is a set of 36 short pieces for guitar by a composer called Ryan Probert. So inspired by the images by Hokusai of Mount Fuji, you know, the most famous one is the Great Wave with the mountain in the background. These little pieces are kind of, they're strange and they're jaunty and they're whimsical and then they stop.
That's a delicacy, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so. I kind of think of it like, you know, when you're looking out of a train window and you see something and you kind of want to strain to keep seeing it, but you've moved on. I kind of feel like those pieces.
Did you know that Debussy so loved Hokusai that he chose the wave for the cover of his masterpiece, La Mer?
Ah, there you go. Yes. I think the other thing that I really like about it is that it's musicians obviously interpreting a score written by a composer who's being inspired himself by an artist who is himself inspired by the natural world.
Well, we heard the great wave off Kanagawa and south wind, clear sky, red Fuji from Ryan Probert's 36 Views of Mount Fuji, performed by the Vickers Bovey guitar duo. Marianne, you've written two books about the British landscape and how to spot hidden histories. What are some of the forms in the landscape that both excite you and that we should sort of look out for?
Well, Michael, it mostly depends where you are in the countryside. The thing that you have to remember about the UK as a whole is that it's been permanently populated since the end of the Ice Age. So we've got a good kind of 12,000 years of human endeavour written into the land around us. So one of the things that I think's most remarkable are those low, round barrows, kind of mounds, tumuli or tumulus. They're burial mounds from the Bronze Age. They're the most common prehistoric monument that you can find in the UK from about 2000 BC.
The Scottish Highlands in particular, the clearances, suggested all kinds of things when you began to look at them.
One of the things that I think we don't necessarily appreciate is how the landscape has changed in more recent history. People see this kind of remote wilderness. Now, it's not a wilderness. If it were, it would be covered in trees. Think of northern Canada, it's the same latitude. But also, the idea that it's this empty, wild space is also not true. Those kind of remote, empty valleys, the land of stags and heather, were, 200 years ago, filled with people living in villages, clachans. They were forcibly cleared after the Jacobite uprising was quashed in 1746. There was a concerted effort to break up those clan systems. And both Scottish and English landowners saw this as an opportunity to effectively get rid of the annoying peasants with their turnips and their potatoes and their cattle and actually turn the land over to sporting estates for shooting stags and sheep farming. And so what we have now is a landscape that actually, I think, speaks of tragedy and loss and depopulation. The clearances have been described as a cultural genocide. It's just one that we don't talk about.
And is there evidence of those communities today?
Yes. So if you walk in the Highlands now, you'll find the remains of clachans. So these abandoned villages, effectively. So low stone foundations of walls. You'll find coffin roads, which were links from parish churches and burial grounds. And you'll also, when you go on to the higher ground, you'll find the remains of shealings, summer pastures. So people would have herded their cattle up to the summer grazing. And we just don't think of that kind of small scale transhumance as part of the cultural, agricultural, natural landscape in the UK. But it was. Just beyond living memory.
Well, this next music, sung in Gaelic, really speaks to those communities, doesn't it?
Yes. So this is a song that was written in 1856 by a man called John Cameron. And the English translation of the title is, I see the big mountains. And he goes on to say, I see the steep mountains, I see the corries, which are the heads of the valleys, and I see the mist-covered peaks. And it's a song of longing for home.
Grandma, the
The mist-covered mountains of home, arranged by James McMillan and performed by the King's Singers. There's something kind of almost melancholy about that, isn't there?
Yeah, hugely tragic. It kind of makes you want to cry a little bit. There's something, isn't there, about the toils of a human life compared to the depth of time that a landscape represents. You feel both tiny and insignificant, but also uplifted and worth something.
And I like the way the melody is handed around the different voices.
Yes, like it's echoing. Yeah.
Yes, so it is like a community group singing.
Yeah, and for those who go, oh, that sounds strangely familiar, it's an adaptation, apparently, of Johnny So Long at the Fair. Oh dear, what can the matter be?
Now, you have travelled, as I said earlier, all around the world, but your next music takes us to Algeria, one of your first adventures abroad when I think you were just about 19. What made you go there?
I had the great fortune of being able to go to Cambridge University to study archaeology and anthropology. And in my second year, this was actually just a piece of A4 pinned up on a notice board saying students wanted to join expedition. And my little ears pricked up. Ooh.
Because you are quite intrepid, aren't you?
Oh, I love an adventure. Yeah, always say yes and work out the details later. It was an expedition to go and look at the rock art that is in the cave shelters in the Ahaggar region of southern Algeria.
Incredibly old.
Yes. So the earliest are about 6,000 BC and the latest 200-ish AD. Basically a time when the Sahara wasn't a desert yet and there were much wetter periods. So these paintings are of animals and people hunting animals and herds of cattle with beautiful kind of spots, and some of it's ochred, some of it's white. You've got these dog-headed men of the Ahaggar, they're known as, human figures but with a dog's head and kind of sticking out ears. The thing about this rock art, even more so now than it was 20 years ago, is that because it's remote and because it's in a volatile region, people will drive in convoys, they're organised gangs, and basically hack out huge panels of these rock shelters, and then they get sold on the illegal art market. So priceless human culture is lost to the rest of us.
And the guides took you to their village?
One of our Tuareg drivers, a guy called Hosseini, said, oh, we're driving close to my family. And we rounded the corner of this great cresting, brilliant red sand dune, And there, what felt like in the middle of nowhere, was a makeshift shelter, his wife, their children, and a couple of goats. And he stopped and we came out and had tea. And the remarkable thing is Tuareg men veil. So as a sign of respect, he, to his wife, but also because we were then visitors to his home, pulled his veil up so all you could see were his eyes. But his wife doesn't veil. I don't know, she was probably only a couple of years older than me. And I marvelled at the skill set that she had to deal with the goats, deal with the kids, deal with the shelter, and survive and thrive in this incredible landscape that was, to me, so inhospitable. But she was smashing it. An opportunity to kind of realise that you don't know everything.
Well, tell me about...
Be humble.
Tell me about the piece of music from The King of Rye, which I think for you speaks of this time.
So the drivers had a kind of set of tapes and they were playing all the pop music that was current in Algeria at the time. And Rye, which is this genre of music, originated in, I think, the 1920s as a sort of folk music, calling out social oppression, calling out disadvantage. It's framed as kind of advice or wisdom, like, hey, I've got something to say. But then in the 70s, 80s and 90s, this folk tradition was kind of fused with Western drums and synths and guitar. Often the Rye singers affixed Sheb, which means young, to their name, in opposition to Sheikh, which means old. So this particular song, sung by the King of Rye, an artist who was then known as Sheb Khaled and is now just Khaled, played morning to evening on our trip in Algeria.
I'm gonna make you mine.
Didi by Khaled, the lead single from the singer's eponymous album Khaled.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It was released in 1992, and I feel like you can really hear the 1990s vibes coming through loud and strong.
Mariana Hotter, one of the things you've been exploring recently is lost sounds. Hmm. Tell us about that.
So often when we think about the past, we revert to effectively a dry, dusty history textbook. It's lost its kind of three-dimensional sensory humanness. And I was working on this Radio 4 documentary called The Lost Sounds Orchestra, and our mission was to bring to life some of the sounds and the work that researchers are doing around the world to bring sound back to our understanding of the past.
And the instruments on which they were made.
Yes, that's right. And the piece that I want to play today is played on the aulos, which is this double reed, double pipe instrument from ancient Greece. It's a bit like playing two oboes at once. So it's got a reed and a pipe, normally made of wood and metal and bone. We find little fragments of these in archaeological contexts. People thought it was a single piped instrument, a bit like a recorder. But then you look at people playing aulos on pottery, vases, wall paintings and mosaics, and they're playing two at once. And sometimes you see them with leather straps effectively around their heads, sort of over their foreheads and across their cheeks. And some of the poetry and writing from ancient Greece also references this, and that the straps were to help you to support your cheeks because the force and the strength of blowing was so great that.
Well, I think they used circular breathing, didn't they? Which is where you breathe in through your nose and breathe out simultaneously through your mouth. And contemporary music players use this, oboists like Nicholas Daniel.
Yes, that's right. One of the myths of the aulos was that Athena, the goddess, tried to play the aulos, but all the other gods and goddesses laughed at her because she looked so silly because she was puffing her cheeks out, bulging at the eyeballs.
Huge pressure.
So she threw them away and she was like, I'm not going to play these anymore. And a satyr picked them up instead and started to play. In ancient Greek culture, the aulos would have been played mostly by professional musicians who were slaves, but also by the leisured aristocrats as a sign of their learning. But the aulos was considered perhaps the lesser, the kithara or the barbiton, the kind of stringed instruments. You could kind of recline and look very elegant whilst playing, whereas the aulos, you know, like you're huffing and puffing as you go.
Well, let's hear an example played not by a slave, but by Callum Armstrong.
And not huffing and puffing, making it look astonishingly easy.
Thank you. Absolutely amazing.
I don't understand. How has he not fallen over Callum Armstrong? What an extraordinary musician.
And he was playing Bellarmine Exercise 101 to explore some of the polyphonic ideas on the Ilos. That means the ability to play two different lines at once or more. The Bellarmine Exercise are a series of ancient musical extracts passed down to us through Byzantine sources. It's been suggested that these musical fragments are exercises for beginner owleteers.
I know, which I laugh at. Give me an owlos and it wouldn't sound like that, beginner exercise or no. So these are fragments of musical notation, pieces of parchment that were collected by a German chap called Bellarmine, so hence the name of the Bellarmine exercises. The thing that we have to remember is that ancient Greek as a spoken language was tonal and rhythmic. So it would have had the long and the short syllables and rising and lowering pitch. And then so many aspects of ancient Greek culture would have been accompanied by music, sometimes taken centre stage. I imagine if Callum Armstrong had lived in ancient Greece, he would have held the floor. But also it was used as an accompaniment to the deeply musical language that was being spoken and the poetry and the plays.
Mm. It's wonderful to actually hear what they might have been listening to, the kind of sounds. So the next music was written about 500 years ago, I think.
So this is a piece that was written in 1520 by Clément Janacan, who imitates birdsong, basically, and uses the notation of birdsong in place of words. The chanson starts with the words, "Awake, sleepy hearts, the god of love calls you. The birds will make you marvel. To lift yourself from dismay, unclog your ears." And so then you listen to the rest of the song and it becomes this cacophony of the dawn chorus.
Looking forward to Olivier Messiaen 500 years later.
Exactly. Inspired by the natural world and doing that extraordinary technical sleight of hand, which is to capture something and then translate it into a musical notation that you could then share with a choir and they perform.
Good.
The Song of the Birds. It's very amusing, isn't it?
It is. It makes you laugh, doesn't it? Partly because, you know, you've got someone going taka, 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 or trilling or what have you. Yeah, exactly. I don't know how you write that down as a score. Last summer, I went up to the Curonian Spit in Lithuania, which is this extraordinary little kind of finger of land. There's a Lithuanian bird observatory there. And I went out at dawn with one of the wardens. And he said, the thing is, when you listen to birdsong, they're all just fighting and shouting at each other about having sex. And I was like, oh, you've ruined birdsong for me forever now.
Well, that extraordinarily visionary music was by the French composer Clément Jeannequin, who lived from 1485 to 1558. And we heard it performed by the Clément Jeannequin Ensemble. And actually, some of his other music imitated the sounds of battles and Paris streets. In 2016, Marianne Lahotta, you were granted access to the area surrounding the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. What was that like, and was it frightening?
So I was making a TV programme for Animal Planet, and we joined the scientists looking at how the animals and other organisms were responding to these conditions of high radioactivity. The air itself is fine, it's the dust that holds these highly radioactive particles. And so little things like voles and shrews and little birds are constantly being exposed. One of the things that was extraordinary was they discovered that some of the kind of small rodents and the birds that reproduce very rapidly, so perhaps have one or two fertility cycles every year, the offspring have started to adapt to these radioactive conditions. And the birds, for example, have changed the colour of their plumage. And the thinking is that some kind of mutation in the melanin production that changes the birds' feathers is actually offering some kind of protective biological factor to the free radicals of the radioactive environment in which they live. If you can pick out how that mechanism is working, then you could use it to help and rehabilitate wildlife, but also people who are affected by nuclear exposure.
Well, your next piece of music returns to the comforts of home.
Yes, this is a piece of music that my husband Joe plays on the piano at home, and he plays it quite slowly, slower than I think a Baroque dancer would choose it to be. I really associate it with effectively making a home with him, preparing for the birth of our first child, and this is something that gives me such profound comfort. Joe's very musical, and I've learnt a lot more about music through him, and now I see him sharing his passion for music and his knowledge with my children, which is just wonderful.
Well, let's hear, sadly not your husband, but Keith Jarrett playing the Courant from the Keyboard Suite No. 4 in E minor by Handel. The Courant, from the keyboard suite number 4 in E minor by Handel, performed by Keith Jarrett, at the same speed as you tend to hear at home?
I don't think Joe does the twiddly bits quite as well as Keith Jarrett. Even he would admit that. But he's very musical. It's quite annoying.
Mariana Hotter, in 2012, you took part in a yacht race across the Pacific, and I wondered what that might have entailed.
So I joined the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. The thing that's remarkable about it is that it's a full stage round the world yacht race, but the crews are amateur sailors. And I joined as a journalist. So we sailed from Qingdao in China across the North Pacific to San Francisco in the US. And the North Pacific, my goodness, Michael, it delivers. We sailed for 28 days and that's going fast. The waves are vast and you don't see any land. We saw a few albatross, that was it. You realise just how much ocean there is and that you are alone. There's no one coming to get you if something goes wrong. It's you and the rest of your crew and the boat. That's your lifeline. There was one night where the wind was very strong. The waves were very, very big and it was requiring two of us on the helm to kind of hold the boat steady. Because what you don't want to do is go surfing down the face of one wave and then roll at the bottom, because then you'll get knocked by another wave. You have to kind of keep going. And it really does feel like you're falling down into the abyss. And there was a debate amongst the more senior sailors about whether we should reef the mainsail so that you've got less power, versus whether it was an acceptable risk to keep the sails as they were and therefore go faster. Of course, it is a race. And at the point where no decision had been made, it was the end of our watch. And I shuffled to the bows of the boat and crawled into my sodden bunk. And I just kept my fowlies on. I kept my sea boots on and I kept my life jacket on, because I thought, you know, if we get dismasted or capsized, I want to have my I want to have my shoes on. And I found my stash of dairy milk, fruit and nut chocolate. And I thought, I'm going to eat it all, because if this is it. And I lay there sodden, cold and tired and really spent. And I had an iPod and this was the song that came on. And I sort of had tears in my eyes thinking, I don't want to die. I must have fallen asleep in a sort of exhausted heap and was shaken awake 3 hours later. The wind had lessened. The boat hadn't capsized. The creaking, the screaming sound of a boat holding its own against the tyranny of Mother Nature outside had lessened. And we did it again.
Well, I think that's a lovely note on which to play out, because it is actually a lullaby that you alighted upon. Good Night, My Angel, the 1994 single by Billy Joel. So it only remains for me to say good night, my angel. And thank you very much, Mariana Hotter.
Thank you for having me.
Good night, my angel, time to close your eyes and save these questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know. Wherever you may go, no matter where you are, I never will be far away. Good night, my angel, now it's time to sleep. And still so many things I want to say. Remember all the songs you sang for me when we went sailing on an emerald bay. And like a boat out on the ocean, I'm rocking you to sleep. The water's dark and deep inside this ancient heart, you'll always be a part of me. Good night, my angel, now it's time to dream, and dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will be.
Lullaby by Billy Joel, ending this week's Private Passions, which was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael Barclay's guest will be the artist Norman Aykroyd.
What makes an essential classic? Is it a work you find yourself humming all day? Music with a timeless nature? Or a piece that gives you the urge to dance around the kitchen? For us here on Essential Classics, there's no one answer, which is why every day you'll hear a mix of the old and new, the lesser known and famous, the traditional and surprising, but always music we love. Essential Classics with me, Georgia Mann, every weekday from 9 till noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, online, and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock. Here's the latest BBC News with me, John Shea. Millions of people in Turkey are going to the polls in what's being seen as a pivotal election. President Erdogan faces a tough challenge from the main opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who leads a six-party coalition. He says he'll scrap many powers acquired by Mr. Erdogan after he survived a failed coup in 2016. The country is still recovering from February's devastating earthquake, which killed more than 50,000 people. A powerful cyclone has begun to hit the coastlines of Bangladesh and Myanmar. Cyclone Mocha has intensified to the equivalent of a Category 5 storm, with heavy rain and winds of up to 120 miles an hour. The Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko has sparked renewed speculation about his health by failing to turn up at an annual event where he usually gives a speech. Some reports claim he was admitted to hospital after leaving last week's Victory Day celebrations in Russia earlier than expected. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has met the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz in Berlin. It's his first visit to Germany since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and it follows Germany's announcement that it would supply almost £2.5 billion worth of weapons to Kiev. The former Archbishop of York, Lord Sentamu, has been forced to step aside from his role in the Church of England after a review found that he failed to act when he was told about a case of child sexual abuse. The Church of England has apologised to Matthew Einarsson, who was 16 when he was abused in the 1980s in Bradford. Tens of thousands of households in West Sussex are without water after a failure at a supply plant. Southern Water said it had shut down the site at Hardham when low levels of chlorine were detected. It's hoped supplies will return to normal in the next 24 to 36 hours. Water is being delivered to vulnerable customers, and a bottled water station has been set up in Billingshurst. The BBC says last night's Eurovision Song Contest final in Liverpool has become the most watched ever by UK viewers. At its peak, 11 million people tuned in. The competition was won by the Swedish singer Loreen. And the weather. Thick cloud cover will build through the afternoon with outbreaks of rain and drizzle across Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales and Northern England.
Australia, a great place for families.
The cost of the journey halfway around the world is £10.
Can't believe we're actually doing this.
Here we go then, start of our new lives.
G'day, g'day. Welcome to paradise.
Brand new drama.
It's like a prisoner of war camp.
He lied to us, showed us whitewashed houses and they showed us huge gardens.
Starring Michelle Keegan.
For the first time in a long time.
We'll be happy.
£10 Poms.
We can have a wonderful life here, but we need to embrace it.
Starts today.